This is Maryland Morning on 88.1. I'm Sheila Cast. Welcome back to The Lines Between Us, our weekly exploration of inequality in the Baltimore region. During our year-long series, we've looked at economic opportunity. The thing about an opportunity is that you have to know about it to take advantage of it. And sometimes that comes down to knowing the right people, not only the people who can tell you about a job opening, but who can put in a good word for you and tell you who to talk to. Today, on The Lines Between Us, we're looking at social networks, not the online kind, our friends and neighbors and acquaintances. How do they shape our job prospects? In a few minutes, we'll talk with a sociologist about how white and black social networks differ in Baltimore's blue-collar job market. But first, local writer Lionel Foster reflects on how he formed the networks and connections that helped him along the way.
Hi, my name is Lionel, and I don't scare white people. This is noteworthy because I can't think of many other 6-foot-tall, 200-pound black men from the hood who can say the same. I don't go out of my way to be non-threatening, but because of stereotypes about how prone to violence young men like me are supposed to be, this ability has served me well. I grew up in East Baltimore. Drugs were rampant. The schools were bad. With so many dangers, each of us had our own way of coping. Some acted out. Sometimes the smartest kids in class were also the loudest. They couldn't articulate it at the time, but they knew the games we played were rigged against us, that our schools looked too much like prisons, and that some of the adults in charge weren't holding up their end of the bargain. I wouldn't realize quite how badly we had it until many years after the fact. Plus, I loved to learn new things, so while many opted out of education, I opted in. As teenagers, some of my peers spent Saturday nights at parties. My family spent Sunday morning in church. And while I liked the snippets of hip-hop I heard here and there on the street, I picked up trumpet in fifth grade and knew a lot more about classical music and jazz. Back then, I found that if you were young, didn't have a lot of resources, and were obviously upset about it, a lot of people just thought, well, he must come from bad seed. But if something, faith or chance perhaps, helped you smile through it, people were more willing to help. A church-going kid who liked Bach, I was deemed worthy of saving, so I found myself in academic summer programs, free music lessons, and a free SAT prep course, which in turn led to magnet schools, study abroad programs, college scholarships, and advanced degrees. But later, as more and more people asked, how did you make it out? How did you survive? I became convinced that some of my success was about more than what I looked like on paper. I looked even better when the gatekeepers to these programs and institutions compared what they now saw in front of them to what they'd come to expect from someone who looked like me. I defied the odds. I spoke their language. And after I was let in, the rapport I developed with everyone from the cashier in college who never let me pay for lunch a year and a half after my meal plan expired to the head of the political science department who wrote one of my recommendations for graduate school was invaluable. At 32, outside of a short stint with a temp agency, a job application has never been my first point of contact with a full-time employer. I either knew my would-be boss personally or had a friend or mentor who passed on my name. But coming from the hood, I would never have met some of the people who have been pivotal to my career if I hadn't cultivated a talent for putting people at ease. So I worry about the kids who are feared or overlooked, the boys who choose jeans over khakis, the Wu-Tang Clan over Wynton Marsalis, who are angry for all the right reasons and didn't want any of their hard edges buffed smooth. Talent takes so many forms. Today, I get paid to write my opinion, but I've heard middle school students on buses trade more skillfully crafted phrases than I could make up after hours in front of my computer. They're wrestling with the complexities of the often tough environments they call home with humor and incisiveness. The untold story of my success is this. Yes, I was smart. Yes, I was hardworking. But I got way too much credit for looking the part and being well-behaved. If we are ever going to do right by Baltimore's children, we'll have to step outside our comfort zones and broaden our networks to include people who don't look or act like us. We'll have to come to terms with some of their justifiable anger and some of our own worst fears so that we can meet them halfway.
Lionel Foster is a writer based in Baltimore. We've got a link to his website at our website, linesbetweenus.org. On 88.1, I'm Sheila Cast. This is The Lines Between Us on Maryland Morning. Today on The Lines Between Us, we're unpacking how who we know plays out along racial lines in the job market. Deidre Royster is a sociology professor at New York University. She did her graduate work in Baltimore at Johns Hopkins University. While there, she put together a study that found that social networks, that is, who you know, put young blacks in search of blue-collar work at a disadvantage. She wrote about it in her book, Race and the Invisible Hand, How White Networks Exclude Black Men from Blue-Collar Jobs, which was published in 2003. We spoke about it last January. I began by asking her what she was trying to find out with her study.
I was looking at what was happening in the labor market in the 1990s as black men began to experience huge numbers of unemployment. Everybody was losing in our deindustrializing economy, but they were losing at rates that were much higher than everybody else's. And the talk around the town, so to speak, was that there was something wrong with black men, that they had a poor work orientation, that they didn't want to work, and that they were not building the skill sets that it would take to get the remaining jobs. And so the explanations for the problems tended to, in some ways, blame the victim. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to explore that, and I wanted to do it in a way that would allow me to see whether there was any truth in those assumptions about black men and their work values and orientation, or whether there were some other factors that better explained why it was that black men seemed to be having even more difficulty than white men were in a deindustrializing economy.
So you put together a group to talk to. Tell us who they were and how you organized this.
I wanted to target young men who were interested in blue-collar work. And so the way to do that in the U.S. is to sort of try to find a vocational high school, especially if you're in a city. Those guys want to work. They want to work early. They often want to do work study. And they're looking for blue-collar jobs, the masculine jobs. And so I was fortunate because at the time, Baltimore had a school that was housing both black and white male students as well as female students and training them for the kinds of vocational blue-collar jobs that I was interested in. So I got to do something rather special, which is to capture young men who had gone to the same high school, sat in the same classrooms, had learned from the same teachers, and gotten to know each other. So these were kids who were equal on what economists call pre-market factors.
Pre-market meaning before they went into the workforce full-time.
Right. And I was able to identify 25 white men and 25 black men and interview them a few years after they had graduated from the same high school to see how their labor market experiences had gone. And so I designed a study that allowed me to look at every single job that they had ever had and how they got it and how long they stayed in it and who helped them get it. And I really was able to present two different pictures of trajectories for young men. And I thought that they might be more similar than they turned out to be, especially since they had gone to the same high school. And I made efforts to find out whether or not they were equal on things that sociologists and economists say are important. So these men were generous enough to let me look at their school records, and I was able to compare both their grade point averages, their attendance patterns, their achievement test scores on standardized tests. And these guys were equal to each other in all the important ways. And in some ways, the black males might have been preferable because their attendance patterns, for example, were a little bit better than the white guys. So it wasn't those kinds of things that explained the divergences that I observed when I caught up with them 2 to 3 years after graduating.
Well, how would you summarize the divergence that you found when you caught up with him?
You know, the divergence among this set of men who should have been equal if race hadn't mattered was very much parallel to what we saw in the national economy and continue to see. So rates of unemployment for black males was twice that of white males, and black males were at least 10% behind black white men's earnings, and usually more than that. And so the same patterns that I found for these working class black and white men are paralleled across the class structure for blacks and whites and continue right up to today. Sometimes worse in certain areas.
From your interviews with them, what explains the discrepancies you found?
You know, I suspected that the social networks that white men and black men are attached to, and we use the word enmeshed within, I hate to use jargon, but all of us are enmeshed within a set of social networks, people that we know and who know us and who help us to figure out things. You know, there are folks who we call if we want to go on a trip and we know they've been there and so forth. Others, if we want a job and we know that that person has a connection to that industry. And working class people use networks. Every class of people uses networks. But networks vary quite a bit. And I found when I studied how blue-collar bound white and black men, how they approach the labor market, networks make a huge difference. And they differ in terms of the content of the folks who are within the networks, but also in how the networks operate for them. And that was something I wasn't quite expecting.
So there was like a white network and a black network, and they really didn't operate the same way?
No, they didn't, and they didn't overlap much either. So white men that I studied were enmeshed within networks that had lots of older white men who tended to be the gatekeepers in the blue-collar jobs that all of the young men wanted.
Gatekeeper in this sense means what?
Gatekeepers are the people who you need to know in order to get your foot in the door of a typical training opportunity or job opportunity in the blue-collar field. So they might be unionists who have to recommend you for an apprenticeship within that union. They could be folks who are doing the hiring for a construction job or in a plant. They are supervisors. They're folks who are in the know and who have some kinds of power within that labor market. So the white men that I studied knew lots of folks who were at those higher levels of power within the blue-collar sphere, and they also knew lots of workers. But among the black men that I met, they knew workers, but they didn't know very many people who did the hiring and the firing and the interviewing, the supervising. They didn't know those folks personally.
This is Maryland Morning on WYPR. I'm Sheila Cass, speaking with Deidre Royster. She's a sociologist and author of the book Race and the Invisible Hand, How White Networks Exclude Black Men from Blue-Collar Jobs, which followed the work history of 25 white and 25 black students from a vocational school in Baltimore. Walk me through the employment trajectory of a typical white student in your study and a typical black student.
Okay, that's a great question. The typical white student was a student who was highly successful in the blue-collar sphere, within or outside of the area that he trained in while he was in vocational high school. So if a guy trained in drafting, for example, his networks were sufficient to get him into electrical construction if he wanted to. If he trained in electrical construction, he found it very easy to get into a union-run apprenticeship program or to be able to get on the workforce in an entry-level electrical construction job fairly easily. But the thing that's interesting about all of the boys' trajectories is that all of them started out doing those kind of dead-end jobs that we talk about, like busboys and things like that. And white boys did those jobs, and so did black boys. But black boys did those jobs longer. And so you might find that in the trajectory, the early part of the trajectory, a white male student would have one or two of those jobs before moving into jobs that were higher skilled, higher paid, and that started to enable them to purchase trucks and their own tools and other things that really make it easier to attain blue-collar employment. For the black men, they were much more likely to continue to have the dead-end jobs, jobs in fast food, jobs that the menial jobs, the jobs that don't have a ladder and that don't enhance your skill set. So they were not able to, for example, start to buy their own transportation, you know, trucks and tools. And those early differences only were exacerbated by later experiences where white men were able to use those ties they had with older white tradesmen to get better and better opportunities. The black men sort of found themselves having to rely much more heavily on their female relatives who did not have contacts in the blue-collar field. And even those who had some male contacts who had those contacts had a harder time and faced direct experiences of discrimination. But also I learned something that really surprised me, which is that networks operate differently for blacks and whites.
And explain that. What did you, I mean, how did these guys tell you it worked? Give me an example of how it worked for one of the white guys and how it didn't work for one of the black guys.
Well, first I'll tell you what my assumption was and how it was violated, and I'll give you a couple of examples. I thought networks worked the same for everybody. That, you know, what happens is that your contact person maybe tells you about a job and tells you, you know, run and get it and tell them I sent you. And for the white guys, that's pretty much exactly the way it works. With black guys, it was more complicated than that. Oftentimes, hearing about a job was about reading about it in a newspaper, not necessarily hearing about it in a job space. But more importantly, sometimes the black men were told, go, but don't mention me. And I said, why? And I got a lesson on how race works in the job setting. Basically, the black contacts said, don't tell them I sent you, because they're not going to be impressed by that. This is a racialized workforce, and the balances are important to those who are doing the hiring and the firing, who are usually white. And so instead of saying, hey, I'm here, and so-and-so sent me, hey, I'm here. And so for blacks, there's this extra calculation that takes place in which they have to decide, is it going to help this person for my name to be mentioned, or might it hurt them? And in several cases, my black males explained to me, they told me not to tell them I sent you because of the racialization in workforces.
You are mixed race. Your mother was white, your father was black, and you are pale-skinned. And you write about how that affected your interviews, how whites assumed you're white, one of them, and that you made sure blacks understood that you're black. Why was that important?
Well, you know, I don't think it's that uncommon these days for mixed race people to sort of, you know, you're passing for white inadvertently. But I was raised in a black family, so I have relatives who are brown, and I look, you know, something other than black. So I've had this experience my whole life of being mistaken for a white person. And so I didn't have any reason to think that that wouldn't happen while I was doing the study. But I wasn't sure it was always going to happen. Most of the time, researchers who think of themselves as black, and you know, when you're raised in a black community, you have a black lens on the world. Some of my perspectives very much, you know, come from that lens. But knowing that I could kind of walk in and out of spaces that were white spaces, and of course, in Baltimore, there are lots of communities in which you know, we think of them as white spaces because people of color aren't very welcome. I felt like I might be able to do this work without trying to convince one of my white colleagues, other graduate students, to come and do the interviews. And I'm certain that I passed for white, not necessarily, you know, trying to fool anybody or anything, just showing up and doing the work the way any other sociologist would. I know that they did not see me as a black person because they used the N-word. They signaled their distaste for programs that were designed to, you know, even things up a bit among blacks and whites. And so that level of candidness, which I'm actually very, very grateful for, and it's an important part of the story, definitely was possible because nothing about me for them signaled non-whiteness. Sometimes when I was trying to get an interview with one of the black male students, and I was worried that he was going to say, no, I don't have time for that, I would say, hey, wait, you know, I'm a sister struggling to get a degree at Johns Hopkins. and that was worth a sympathy point. And nothing about me, I think, would have signaled to them easily that I thought of myself as an African-American woman and certainly was experiencing Johns Hopkins, you know, as a minority person who could much more relate to folks who were working on the campus rather than teaching on the campus. I'm from a lower middle class background myself. So my identity in some ways allowed me to be at home in both spaces. And the men, white and black, were uniformly kind, considerate, polite, really, really nice to me. And I'm so grateful to them for telling me their stories.
Deirdre Royster is a sociology professor at New York University and author of the book Race and the Invisible Hand, How White Networks Exclude Black Men from Blue-Collar Jobs. We spoke in January. We've got a link to Royster's book on our series website, linesbetweenus.org. I'm Sheila Cast. Coming up on The Lines Between Us, Tom Hall talks with the directors of The Central Park Five, a documentary about the wrongful rape conviction of five New York City black and Latino youths. Stay with us on 88.1.